All right, good morning, everybody, and welcome to today's Internet webcast covering an introduction to brownfields in EPA Region 8. My name is Ted Lanzano, and I'm with the Region 8 Brownfields Program, and I'll be moderating today's session. Dan Heffernan of our Brownfields Program is also with us today, and he will be our presenter. I hear a few beeps going on still, so I'm just going to go through a couple housekeeping items as people continue to join us, and then we'll get started with today's presentation. So today's session is intended to provide a general overview of EPA brownfields opportunities to local governments and nonprofits and redevelopment agencies and states here in Region 8. We'll be highlighting some previous success stories as well as grant funding opportunities. It really is an introductory session, but if you'd like to get more in-depth, we will be having more technical online sessions later on in the summer, and we encourage you to join us there. So when you are registered, you are directed to the seminar's specific URL page, and you'll see that this contains a short overview of today's session, and you can also can click on the name of the presenters for short bios on ourselves, and you'll see our email addresses are also hot-linked on that page in case you have any follow-up questions for any of us after today's presentation. Today is really designed to have maximum participant interaction. The presentation will actually be fairly brief and will allow plenty of time for questions. You can submit questions electronically by using the question mark icon you'll see above the first slide. You don't need to wait until the QA period to submit your questions via the website. You can submit these any time, and as moderator, I'll be keeping track of these. And of course, if you'd rather just ask your question at the end, no problems. I think we only have about 30 people on the line, and we'll have plenty of time for you to do so. During the presentation, we ask that you put your phone on mute. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, take a moment right now to hit *6 to place your phone on mute. And when you get to the question and answer period, you can hit #6 to unmute the phone. And also, please don't put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements, and I'm well sure it's very nice music and maybe even inspirational. It can be a little disruptive to the call. So by now you should have all clicked on the Go To session icon to access today's presentation. Dan, our presenter, will be announcing the number of the slide to which he is moving, and you can move along and you can advance by just using the right arrow located above the slide or just by clicking on the appropriate slide number on the left-hand frame.
Hey, Ted, this is Stephanie Wallace. I can't open it. Is anyone else got an hourglass that just goes on and on and on? Or is everybody else able to get in? Maybe it's just me. I'll try again.
Okay. If anybody has problems opening the presentation, just chime in and we'll see what we can do. Stephanie, hope yours will advance soon here.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so just real quick, at the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our links page. Will you be able to access info on resources, contacts, fact sheets, and other websites directly applicable to today's topic? And this will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. And we typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack from today, so you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation that was given today. At the end of the session, we hope you'll fill out an online feedback form. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery, so we hope you'll take the time to fill those out. So I think we're ready to kick off today's session, and I'll pass it over to Dan.
Great. Thanks a lot, Ted. My name is Dan Heffernan. Good morning, everybody. Glad to have a good number of folks on the line today. I hope this is a useful hour and a half of your time. As Ted said, I am Dan Heffernan with the EPA Region 8 Brownfields Program. Before I go any further, are folks able to get to the slides? Was that just an isolated problem out there? So you should be on a slide number one in the bottom right corner that says Turning Eyesores into Assets. And like Ted said, there's a question mark button at the top of your screen where you can send in questions at any time. And if you're having any kind of technical difficulties, just let us know or you hit that question mark button and it'll get to ourselves or technicians. Hearing no problems. Like I said, Dan Heffernan with US EPA Region 8. We work in Montana, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, the Dakotas. Did I leave anybody out? And then we work along with 27 different tribal nations that exist within this part of the country as well. Very large land mass, and a very varied economy throughout this region. But it's a pleasure to get to work in this area, and it's a pleasure to get to talk with all of you today. We also have a number of folks on the line from outside of this region of the country, and I want to say welcome to you all. I've seen people from Louisiana on the line and elsewhere, and that's great. I'm glad that you're calling in. Just want to recognize that you do have regional offices that will be your main contact for brownfields related work and concerns and opportunities. And if you need information on that, feel free to contact us and we'll put you in contact with them. Like Ted said, this is a fairly introductory level presentation. This is mostly meant for those who are new to brownfields or are new to this region of the country. I'm going to keep the presentation piece fairly short, and hopefully there'll be a lot of questions and ideas that come up. Feel free to send those in, or at the end we'll just open it up and folks can ask anything they'd like to. With that, I'm going to ask folks to advance to slide number 2, and we will just kind of jump into what the definition of brownfields really are. I'm sure people have heard of these before. Even if you've never heard this name before, you know what a brownfield is. There are a number of different definitions out there. People describe brownfields in different ways. EPA's is generally the driest definition and probably the least clear oftentimes as well. So that's kind of a dubious honor that we're dry and we're unclear. But we get our definition from Congress, the 2002 Brownfields Amendment to the CERCLA law, to the what is commonly referred to the Superfund law. And it's there in quotations. I'm not going to read the quotation to you. What I'm going to say is that in layman's terms, brownfields are basically underutilized properties or vacant properties where there is potential for contamination or fear of some kind of contamination that is contributing oftentimes to that property being vacant or underutilized, and where there's a potential to reuse it, where there's a potential to redevelop it or to turn it into some other kind of community asset, even if it's not redeveloped. I'll ask to advance to slide 3. This slide 3 just highlights some typical brownfield scenarios that we commonly come across in EPA Region 8. They don't all exist in every corner of this region, but they do tend to pop up time and time again. I'll highlight a couple others that aren't listed here. Rail yards, which we'll be highlighting some examples later on. Grain elevators. Plating facilities. Sawmills. These are typical facilities that either are not being fully utilized anymore or are out of business, vacated at this point. And oftentimes there's some level of contamination or fear of contamination. The point here is brownfields is a catch-all term. There are estimates, there have been a number of studies out there, but there are estimates that there are anywhere from 500,000 to over 1 million brownfields properties across the country. They're not limited to large cities. They're not limited to the East Coast. They're not limited to Detroit and Cleveland. They exist in small communities, as most of these examples that I'm going to be highlighting later on will show. These properties, these challenges exist pretty much everywhere, and sometimes they're not even in communities. Sometimes they're out in the backcountry, in the case of mine-scarred lands. So they really are everywhere, and the terminology is really meant to be as inclusive as possible. The other thing that kind of is across the board on brownfields is that these are not generally properties that are ever going to be dealt with under a federal authority, if you're thinking of like a Superfund law, there's generally not the level of contamination or the level of potential threats to public health or the environment that would warrant any kind of an enforcement activity, a regulatory activity on these sites. So in general, the feds aren't ever going to come in to do anything about it. It's kind of the point on most brownfields. Slide four. This is a basic overview of the benefits of brownfields reuse. Not every single benefit is going to be captured in every community, but this is, you know, we're generally talking about an increase in tax base, new job development, utilizing existing infrastructure, taking development pressure off of green space, off of farmland, etc. This is a big one in EPA Region 8. How do you encourage businesses to locate into the downtown corridor as opposed to outside of town? A couple of highlights on these brownfields reuse benefits. In the last decade or so, since, you know, the mid to late 90s, there have actually been billions of dollars in tax revenues that have been generated by brownfields redevelopment nationwide. Just with EPA's involvement with brownfields through our grant programs, which I'll touch on, we've seen the generation of thousands of jobs, permanent jobs, through brownfields work. So it's substantial impact. If you're familiar with areas like lower downtown Denver, the Lodo District, which is actually where our EPA office is here in Denver, in the mid-1990s, this was considered a skid row. This was an area that you did not want to go into at night. Numerous blighted properties, former factories, former warehouses, etc., that have been vacated. Now this area is in the midst, or it may be on the tail end, of a huge urban redevelopment. This is now one of the most desirable zip codes in Colorado. So it can have a huge impact on a portion of a city. Staying with that theme of some examples, if you will advance to slide number five, I'm just going to run through some examples of some really successful community projects in EPA Region 8 that our office has had the pleasure of working with these communities on, and I'm just going to kind of touch on some key factors for each one of these and some of their key successes. I'm going to start off with Evanston, Wyoming. As you can see from the slide, Evanston, Wyoming is a fairly small community, you know, just over 11,000 population. It's a former railroad community. It's what it was founded based on. It's in southwestern Wyoming, kind of in the southwestern corner of Wyoming. The whole city is basically built around a 27-acre area that was the rail yards. This was on the Union Pacific line, running between the Midwest and California, and this was a major area for working on steam engines. The rail yard itself was built in the early 1900s, 1912 or so. The roundhouse machine shop and the powerhouse were developed in 1912. By the early 1990s, the 27-acre property was basically not in use anymore. The community saw this as, I mean, it's located just adjacent to downtown, so the community saw this as a major goal, is to do something about this vacant property now. What's really neat about this project is the level of community involvement on the front end, and we'll kind of use this word a few times, but their visioning process for what they saw as the future of this area and what their goals were for this area. They had a very heavy community involvement process in the late 90s and early 2000s. They had a number of steering committees that they developed. They developed a number of goals for the redevelopment, including they wanted to preserve a number of the key structures on the site, including the roundhouse, which was the last fully existing roundhouse on this rail line. They wanted to develop some green space, create some green space in the area to make a community asset, and then they wanted to develop some community or some commercial development in the area. So they had historic preservation, economic development, creation of green park areas. They had a lot of those multiple use goals that oftentimes can conflict with one another if you don't get stakeholders involved early on, voicing what their interests are in the process. So they had a 54-person steering committee in a town of 11,500 people. They had a number of design charrettes and different meetings around what the vision for the project would be. There was contamination on the site. They were able to get funding from EPA and the state of Wyoming to identify and assess that contamination, and then they've done some cleanup work. There's been asbestos, petroleum, a number of different contaminants that are commonly associated with rail yard areas. The local community has been able to be actively involved in those processes. In 2004, they opened up the renovated machine shop, which is now a conference convention center area. And they continue to fundraise and work towards their ultimate goal, which will be the roundhouse, which is a 64,000 square foot building. The roundhouse will be renovated into their municipal offices to pull together all of City Hall, pretty much. That's their long-term vision for this project, and it's going to take a number of years to get there, but I'm fairly confident that they're going to get there based on their local champions. I'm going to advance on to slide number 5 now, or 6, I'm sorry. This is a similarly sized city in a different part of EPA Region 8, Yankton, South Dakota. This is kind of southeastern South Dakota, not quite Iowa, not quite Nebraska, not quite Minnesota, but right in that corner. Yankton, South Dakota is a population of about 13,000 folks. This community in the mid-90s identified that they had 3 or 4 properties within town that they'd like to do something about. They did do a brownfield inventory and assessment phase in the late 90s and early 2000s, and they basically identified that their primary focus needed to be on a particular property that's at the kind of the gateway into their town as you're coming into town on the highway from the east. As you came into town, there was a large scrap yard right as you came in. And you can see this in the left photo on slide 6. That was your vision as you came into town. And this is a lovely town in southeastern South Dakota. And that's not what they wanted people seeing when they first came into town. So the town, again, they went through the community involvement piece and such. But what I wanted to highlight here is that the city of Yankton took ownership of this property. They acquired the property from the scrapyard owner, got him to move off-site, got him to move his operations to another location outside of town, and the town then went about the process of fully characterizing contamination on the site, removing the bulk of the scrap material. And then there was soil remediation that was then done. They used grant funding, again, worked closely with their state Department of Environmental Quality. And as you can see from that, the photo on the right there, that's as the property stood roughly a year ago. We're looking at a clean piece of property right as you drive into town, and it's ready for redevelopment. And in the interim, they're going to use this area as parking space. This is very close to the Missouri River, and they get a heavy usage there. They have large festivals and such, so they're going to use this as parking space. But ultimately, I believe that the community's idea is to redevelop this parcel. So if we can advance on to slide number 7. This is shifting gears somewhat. This is Ouray County, Colorado. Now we're looking at a community in the hundreds, not in the thousands. This is fairly rural. This is western slope of Colorado, nearly in Utah. Ouray County was a boom town during the mining years, the 1800s. this was a very rich vein through this area in its mining heyday. The economy has now squarely shifted from mining to a tourism and recreation-based economy. And what the local community had identified with this particular watershed, which is up above town, is that they had two interests here. The first was they know there's a lot of old mining claims, and they were concerned about the impacts on water quality. And then the second concern was these old mining claims are privately owned, and property could be transferred, and people could build homes onto them. And somehow Ouray County then would have to, or would be pushed toward providing services, road, electric, et cetera, back into this open space area that abuts national forest. This is high mountain terrain. This is kind of where Jeep claims that it got its start. So this is not exactly where the county wanted development to go. So they got an assessment grant with EPA, and they went back into this watershed, and they looked at over 231 mining claims over a 2,200-acre area of the watershed. And they went through a prioritization process determining which of these mining claims, what the ownership is, what the potential environmental contamination is, and then what the likelihood of being able to gain ownership of these properties, transfer ownership. In the end, this project was able to facilitate the transfer of ownership of 133 acres to the U.S. Forest Service, which is one of the goals of this, was to get these abandoned mining claims into public ownership so that they could never be built upon. Highly successful project, no redevelopment component whatsoever. The reuse is open space and public access. So just a different type of brownfield project. They also were able to characterize, go out and take samples on some of the most highly contaminated sites in the watershed with the goal of developing their own voluntary cleanup remediation for those sites. So that's a long-term environmental goal of this project. If you'll advance on to slide number 8, we'll look at a project in Miles City, Montana. Approximately 8,000 population in Miles City. This is far eastern Montana, east of Billings, if you're familiar with Montana. I believe it's closer to North Dakota than it is to Billings. So rather rural eastern Montana. This community in Miles City identified a former hospital structures that had been abandoned as a blight on the community and an opportunity to get to something that a market analysis had shown them they had a need for in the community, which was affordable housing. One problem standing in their way was that the building's full of asbestos. We were able, as EPA in the state of Montana, to help them abate that asbestos concern and build it. Hello? Okay. The asbestos concern was abated, buildings have been renovated, and they now have 21 affordable housing units there in a relatively short period of time from when they actually began this project. And these are in high demand. As you can see the building on the left. We're talking about a nice structure downtown for residential. So one thing to highlight on this one is they had huge leveraging as far as we're concerned. They were able to bring in a lot of dollars. On the slide you see they leveraged more than $5 million. The money came from US EPA, but we were a small portion of it, USDA, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, USDA is US Department of Agriculture, the state of Montana, and then a number of private sources as well. So you can leverage a lot of money, and it doesn't matter if you're the city of Denver or you're Miles City, Montana. You can get these kind of projects done, and there are dollars available if you've got local champions and you've got a vision for what you'd like to do. If you'll advance to slide number 9, I'm going to briefly switch gears here just a little bit and switch to a couple larger city examples just to show, you know, Region 8 is largely small and rural communities, but we do have big city redevelopment happening here as well, and we're very proud of it, and we want to encourage more of it. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This is a growing community in southeastern South Dakota. The major challenge identified by the community was the downtown corridor was separated from the Big Sioux River and the 300-foot falls, the main feature of the town, was separated by salvage yards, junkyards, brick warehouses, and railroad tracks. In the mid-1990s, or early 1990s, really, the community saw this as a priority, was how do we reconnect the downtown area to the actual, to the waterfront? This was a very complex project that the city undertook. We're talking about a number of parcels, varied ownership, transferring ownership and acquiring properties from both willing and involuntary landowners. It took more than a decade to complete into the couple years ago when they actually got to completion on this. But they were successful, and they were able to reconnect their downtown area to the riverfront, incorporating a park along the waterfront, which was the goal of the community. They were able to acquire a number of pieces of property. They were able to work a deal with the railroad to get the tracks out of the area. And now they have a very successful commercial and residential corridor that was previously salvage yards and rail fields. And for anybody who's been to Sioux Falls, South Dakota and had been there previously, this is a tremendous facelift that this area has gotten, and it's been a huge boon to their economy. If you'll advance to the next slide, we'll go to kind of the mega project. We've got a few of these in the Denver area. Salt Lake City's done a few of these. Murray City, Utah, has done a few of these. This is the Gateway District in Salt Lake City, Utah. This is a large area on the west side of Salt Lake City, 650 acres, give or take. 325 different parcels make up that 650 acres. The determination made in the mid-1990s was that roughly 50% of those parcels were contaminated. So we're talking about a lot of environmental contamination in this former rail field area. The goal initially was to redevelop this area into 10,000 residential units, and to incorporate what we now call mixed use or smart growth. That they wanted to have cultural facilities, they wanted commercial development, they wanted to have a transportation hub for their public transit systems, rail and bus. They wanted to have all of this housed in this area where the property values were, at the time in the mid-90s, were roughly 4% below market value. So this was a very blighted, difficult area for the city of Salt Lake City that was a drain on their tax base, pretty much, on their economy. If you'll advance to the next slide, slide number 11. This is now the Gateway District, looking the same direction as the previous slide. This image is a couple years old now, but I think you get the picture. They have had hundreds of millions of dollars in private investment. I'm not sure what the current figure is at, but they've had a few different developments that were well over $300 million. They've had at least 4,000 new permanent jobs created in the district. The transit hub, the public transit hub that they had envisioned, came to fruition and was dedicated, I believe, in 2007. And a LEED certified, that's Leadership in Environmental Design. It's a green building. And that was completed last year. And now this is an area that's generating huge amounts of tax revenues for Salt Lake City and has spurred a lot of other redevelopment in that part of the city And so, huge success. We will now advance on to slide number 12. This is a brief introduction to EPA's approach to brownfields. It's kind of a different approach for an agency that's primarily regulatory. But we encourage local solutions to local challenges. Brownfields is not about EPA swooping in and taking over. Brownfields is about assisting local communities and identifying their challenges and helping them to overcome those challenges. We stress partnership and stakeholder involvement. There's going to be some slides on that as we come up later. And then what we're best at is identifying and addressing the barriers to cleanup and redevelopment. That's where really where we're the best partner for local communities. If you'll advance to the next slide, 13. These are the general elements or steps of brownfields revitalization, and we feel like these hold true whether you're in a small community or you're a large city. These steps are pretty much the progression that needs to take in order to have successful projects. With that said, you may not always go through all of these steps. You may never need to prioritize brownfields because your community may only have one that you're concerned about. So you may go from identifying that one contaminated site or potentially contaminated site to conducting your environmental assessment and getting ready to redevelop that site. So this is a linear progression that we see as the most successful, but it doesn't necessitate taking every single step every time. We're going to be going through these kind of step by step here over the next few slides. If you'll advance to slide 14. Slide 14 is kind of the overarching message of brownfields, and if you want to ensure success, this is the one to keep in mind at all times. Begin with the end in mind. What is your future goal? It's not, we don't like this empty building, or we're concerned about contamination from that area. Well, what do you want to do with it? So you need to begin with what your main goal is. You want to revitalize Main Street. You want to have a park along the riverfront. What do you want to do? And then how are you going to get to it? Is there already a plan or a vision that can encapsulate that goal? Do you have a 20-year plan for your community? Are there special zones that have already been established? For example, tax zones or enterprise zones, empowerment zones, things like that, that maybe financially may behoove that area. And then the third one, and I'll harp on this for the next few slides, is who has an interest in the area? You know, who are the stakeholders in this? Are there conflicting interests? It may take some work to determine that, but that's got to be right up at the beginning of your process. It's who's got an interest here? Slide number 15. When you're on this, at this front end of the process, your visioning considerations, that first bullet, engage key stakeholders. Well, what's a stakeholder? What do stakeholders mean? Who are the stakeholders? I've got a slide dedicated to that, so I'll skip that one for the moment. But the second one, analyze the regional demographics and economics and market data. What's right for this area? Condominiums aren't right for everywhere. You're not always going to have commercial redevelopment. There's not always going to be some developer interested in developing a parcel. So to the extent that you've got market research and you've got demographics information for the area, is your population aging? Are they changing in character in one way or another? How will that play into your vision for the area? And then the third one is consider a variety of reuses for the area. Not every area is going to have the same ability. Not every property is going to have the same ability to support residential or commercial. So consider a number of different reuses for a property. The other thing is that if there is environmental contamination, you may not have the property cleaned up ever to a level where it's appropriate for residential, for example. It may be more appropriate for a commercial reuse or a light industrial reuse. So if you'll advance on to the next slide, 16, this is sticking with the visioning theme. Who are your stakeholders in the area? It's going to vary from place to place. This is not an exhaustive list that I've got here. The best way to engage stakeholders is to have some public meetings and see who starts showing up. You're going to know who your if you don't have those public meetings up front, if you don't get a robust list of stakeholders and actively engage them, you're going to find out later who your stakeholders are, because they're not going to be happy in one way or another. And that's a stakeholder group you missed out on. Generally, the rule of thumb is the more groups, the more folks that you involve on the front end of things, the less grievance you're going to have later, the less you're going to have folks saying they didn't get an opportunity to provide input. But on the flip side, on the positive side, the more robust your project's going to be, because all those people are going to be adding value from the very beginning. So basically, this is one of the things that we see as one of the main keys to successful projects, is active stakeholder involvement early on, engaging as many people and groups as possible. Slide 17. Slide 17 has to do with prioritizing brownfields. If you've got four or five different properties in town, what are you going to deal with first? Which ones are your priorities? How does it fit into your master plan? This one really is all about knowing your challenges and your opportunities. If your goal is to have affordable housing and your brownfields are all, you know, eighth of an acre gas stations, they don't seem real commensurate there. There's a challenge there, because your problem and your goals don't match up very well. You need a larger size project for your affordable housing, likely. So prioritize your brownfields and keep in mind what your goals are throughout that prioritization process. The next slide, 18, this is the slide that generally EPA would spend the bulk of this presentation discussing, and instead I'm going to wrap it up in one slide here. And we spend so much time on it because this is what we really know here at EPA. Once you've prioritized your sites and you want to look at some and you have a concern that there may be some contamination there, we generally do things called environmental assessments on those. Phase ones, phase twos. A phase one assessment, in a nutshell, is kind of a historic review, a legal review, of the previous site uses. It involves interviewing previous occupants and neighboring property owners and things like that. And you're basically trying to build up a list of likely contaminants of concern. What might be on this property based on its previous use, based on its historic use. It's kind of a book report on a property where an environmental professional can then make an estimated determination as to what is likely on that property or what the concerns may be. A phase two is when there are some likely contaminants on the property. The property was a former dry cleaner, former scrap yard, former service station, etc. There's likely contamination there. You need to get some more information on it. A phase two is where you actually will do sampling for. You'll investigate the property further. You'll do sampling on it and determine whether contamination actually exists or it's not actually there. And then, based on the information from that, your next steps, I've got cleanup required with a question mark. On the left there, if your sampling has determined that no, actually it's a clean site. And oftentimes phase ones and phase twos end up basically just dispelling concern about contamination and show that there actually is no contamination on the site. If there's none, then you go ahead and you market that property and you give some environmental assurance to people that they're getting a clean piece of property. The value of that property should have increased based on that. If, yes, there does, if contamination does pop up, environmental contamination does, that's not the end of the world, as we've just seen with those last few slides. There is assistance out there. There's funding out there. There's technical assistance. We're fortunate in EPA Region 8 to have wonderful environmental departments within each of the states here that are tremendously helpful to their local communities. EPA has grants available to help deal with contamination. So just because there's contamination on the site doesn't mean it needs to be mothballed and kind of put on a shelf and not dealt with. These properties are being dealt with all over the country. So how do you get started in this process? This is an introductory call. It's targeted towards folks who are kind of new to this concept. Slide number 19 is kind of the getting started slide. The first thing you ought to do is just contact somebody with EPA Brownfields Program or your Department of Environmental Quality within your state, so that you don't start reinventing wheels. There are projects throughout every state in the country that are similar to yours. We've got very few totally unique projects out there, and we can put you in contact with folks who know what, you know, they know what the pitfalls are and they know what the opportunities are. And we also know where the resources are. So the first and foremost thing is get in contact with folks, and the people at your environmental quality office in your state or with EPA are more than happy to help you. The second thing is start doing some research. There's so much available on the web with regard to brownfield assessment, cleanup, and redevelopment. And I'm going to go over some websites here as we get further on in the presentation. But start doing some research on this. The third thing is attend workshops and conferences. Again, I'll highlight some that are coming up. But there are a number of workshops and conferences out there where you can attend presentations and get in contact with folks who do this for a living or have had a lot of experience doing this in their own community. And then the fourth one, and probably the easiest, is sit right at your desk and log on for these type of web-based seminars. This CLUIN website is an EPA website where we do these kind of presentations all of the time. They are all archived on the website here, including the streaming audio. And so you can log on for these presentations and listen as you follow along with the slides. So there's a number of different presentations available online. The next slide, 20. This is the show me the money slide. This is all about leveraging funding, and I kind of will start with a disclaimer here that that first bullet is probably the most true of all. You've got to consider a range of funding sources. That Miles City, Montana project had Department of Agriculture, HUD, EPA. They had private money from a number of different corporations. To get these projects completed, especially the ones that do have contamination on them, it takes finding money all over the place. Evanston, Wyoming, they do fundraisers and fundraising balls every single year to raise money for their projects. So you've got to get creative and you've got to look around for the money. Understand who's eligible for the money. Is your government, is your nonprofit, whatever your status may be, are you eligible to receive funding from the different sources that you've identified? Build your partnerships with the state economic development agencies. Their job is to help get funding for projects in your community. Local nonprofits, foundations, you know, you're basically going to have to beat the bushes. And there are a number of websites that list all of these various funding sources that have been identified by communities and academics, but it's not exhaustive for sure. One good suggestion there is that last bullet, holding an in-person meeting with potential funding sources. To the extent that you can get folks out to your community and get them to buy into your vision for your project, you're going to create more champions out there who are going to be involved in trying to get funding for you. So just an idea there. Slide number 21, this is the other slide that EPA would normally spend a lot of time harping on. but I'll start this off by saying that we're going to do some in-depth training on our grants and our guidelines for our grants for folks who are interested in applying for money. We're going to do some of those trainings in July and August. So I'm just going to hit on this real quickly just so folks know what EPA has available. You can see the dollar figures there. This has changed some from years past for folks who are familiar with our grant programs. But we've got money to assess inventory, properties, et cetera. That's that first bullet. We've got money to directly clean up properties. And then we've got money to create revolving loan funds to clean up properties. We also have non-grant assistance, which is that fourth bullet in the form of targeted brownfield assessments. If you've got a property or two in town that, or not in town, that you're interested in getting redeveloped or you think you have a good reuse for and you need to get an assessment done on it, we can actually use our contractors to come out and do an assessment for you. And then you can use that for your future planning. So non-grant, you basically fill out a one-page request to us, and then we come out and do it for you, and no administrative burden on your end. So just so people know, the EPA grants program is an annual grant program. $74 million, give or take, each year is put out there to cities, tribes, counties, redevelopment agencies, states, and nonprofit organizations. So governments and nonprofits are who are eligible for our grants. We've had a number of successful projects throughout EPA Region 8 to date. I just highlighted some of them earlier, but we're very proud of the communities in our region, and we're happy that we've gotten to partner with so many. We're hoping to partner with more in the future. Hopefully some of you will consider our grant programs. Our guidelines have actually been recently revised and will be out later this summer. This is how you actually apply for the funding. And we've revised these guidelines trying to make them, trying to level the playing field, really, is the main goal of this. We're trying to make the guidelines clear to folks who are not professional grant writers. We're trying to make it so that people in non-urban areas, non-big cities, are having a fair shot at getting these dollars. So we've made a number of changes to our grant programs to try and go in that direction. So if you've got specific questions on that, feel free to contact me. But again, we'll go over the grant proposal guidelines in greater detail in July and August. That's it on EPA grants. Slide number 22. Oh, not quite it on grants. Sorry about that. One more. I just wanted to let folks know, if you are interested in applying for grants, the call for proposals will be in the late summer, probably the end of July, and then we'll have a 90-day application window where you can apply, probably ending on Halloween. And just to recognize or to acknowledge, these are highly competitive grants. We get well over 800 applications a year and dole out award maybe 290 or so. So maybe 1 out of 3 success rate of getting funded. I say that to just encourage folks to get started now if you want to apply for grant funding in the late summer and early fall. And how do you do that? You start doing your research. You start planning for what your reuse would be. You start having public meetings. You review the draft guidelines, which I have there on the fourth bullet. We put out the draft guidelines, which are very similar to what will be the final guidelines that we'll put out this fall, so that people have a good idea of what the questions will be, where the points will be allocated, because it is a competitive process. So start looking through those and start considering how they might fit in with your community. Okay, that's it for our grants now. Slide number 23. These are the folks in EPA Region 8 here in Denver. I've put what folks' specialties are and how they can best assist you. We've got a very strong team here. We're very focused on customer service and the public being our customer. We're here to help you at all times. Please feel free to contact us. Our contact information is located on our website there. I can just give you my phone number if you want to jot it down. It's 303-312-7074. and that's located on the clue-in sign-in page as well. And so that's our team. We've got a lot of expertise here within our regional office that we're more than happy to assist you with. If you'll advance on to slide number 24, slides 24 and 25 are the websites and the primary contacts for each of our state partners throughout the six states and EPA Region 8. These are critical partners. EPA and Congress sees the brownfish program as being co-implemented between the EPA and our state partners. These are very helpful websites. These individuals are probably more familiar with your community than someone at EPA would be, so they're a great first person to contact with questions if you don't already know these folks. Advancing on to slide number 26, skipping 25 as it was additional state contacts, here are some good web-based resources. There's a lot on brownfields on the Internet, but here are some that we think are especially strong. The first being our own homepage, EPA Region 8. We spend a lot of time and put a lot of resources into our website and think it's a good first step for folks, a good portal for finding out more information and locating other resources. I encourage you to go to that website. The second being smarte.org. This is an online brownfield and revitalization tool that was developed under an EPA grant, which really has steps, the how-tos, for each piece of the brownfields project that I showed in that linear trajectory, from your stakeholder involvement and inventory of properties all the way through cleanup and redevelopment. This is a great kind of an encyclopedia of resources, is this smarte.org. And then if you're just interested in brownfield funding and potential grant opportunities, both EPA and other federal, the third bullet there, the Brownfields Money Matters page. This is an EPA headquarters page where it's always got the most up-to-date information on which grants are available and what the time frame will be on those. Slide 27. I just wanted to highlight a couple of upcoming trainings and workshops that folks may be interested in. The first being that we're going to offer on July 17th and August 13th a Brownfields Proposal Guidelines seminar, understanding the EPA Brownfields Proposal Guidelines for writing for grants to us. This will be offered by our office. We're going to go through the guidelines piece by piece, and we're going to give you all the tips and tricks for how you write these proposals. I would encourage you to get started looking at the draft guidelines now, developing what your questions may be, but I think that's a fairly valuable use of people's time from what we've gotten, feedback we've gotten in the past. We'll have details on that on our homepage, which has been listed there, and as well as you can just go to this clueIn.org webpage where this current webinar was advertised and see details on it. The last bullet there is the Western Brownfield Workshop. This is a workshop, EPA Regions 8, 9, and 10. That's basically everything from Colorado and the Dakotas west. Regions 8, 9, and 10 have an annual workshop in the fall with hundreds of participants, actually, that is driven by community, by local government folks, by nonprofit folks. They develop the agenda. They are the presenters at it. We basically just provide a space and facilitate some of it. But this is a great opportunity to learn, and I encourage folks to attend this workshop. It, too, will be advertised on the EPA Region 8 Brownfields webpage that is listed on this slide. Slide number 28 brings us to the conclusion of the formal presentation piece. And I'm hoping that there are some questions out there and that people will fire in with them. We can look at one that was sent in already online. This is coming out of Montana. The question is, how do state environmental partners, the Department of Environmental Quality or the Department of Public Health, depending on which state, interface with EPA on projects? And the short answer to that is it's it's not always the same what the interface is with EPA in the state. Oftentimes, when we're talking about brownfield projects where there's EPA funding involved, at least at the assessment phase, EPA is the primary point of contact for the local community. We're going to be the ones who are primarily assisting you through the process while keeping the state DEQ in the loop on things. Once you move into the cleanup phase of projects, if there is a cleanup phase of a project, the state generally then has primacy. They're generally the one that will be your primary point of contact, whether it's through a grant or you're funding it yourself or a developer's funding it or whomever. If there's a cleanup, it will generally go through the state voluntary cleanup program of your state, and then will be overseen by the state, and EPA will have more of a peripheral role at that point. Does that answer your question? All right. Okay. Other questions or comments out there? That was the only one that was sent in. So we'll open it up. If you want to hit, what is it, pound six?
Right. If you have a question, you can hit pound six to unmute your phone. So, yeah, we'd love to hear from folks if you have any questions on the presentation or anything else related to the topic.
Hi, I have a question.
Yeah, go for it.
Hi, Dan, it's Pat Willits.
Hi, Pat.
Hey, I don't know if this was in the scope of what you wanted to talk about today, but I wonder if you could just expand on funding that's projected to be available for the for cleanup grants. I saw you had $200,000 listed on the slide. Is that kind of a limit, or what do you know about that?
Yeah, so for the EPA Brownfield Cleanup Grant, this is a direct grant to a local government or a nonprofit organization to do a cleanup of contaminated property. The Brownfields Law, the 2002 Brownfields Law from Congress that authorizes the money, sets a ceiling of $200,000 per property for those cleanup grants. So we can't award grants for more than $200,000 for cleanups. There have been a number of groups that have been lobbying to increase that amount, lobbying Congress to increase the amount of those cleanup grants, as well as to increase the general amount of funding that EPA is given that we then dole out in grants. But the $200,000 ceiling is the amount per property.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Did I hear someone else beep in?
And you can also submit your questions online if you have them as well. So we're taking them from both ends here.
Okay, I'll read another one from online. What is the process for extracting a cleanup when contamination has been identified and a primary responsible party has been named? Okay, I'm not sure what extracting a cleanup, that portion of it means. What is the process for extracting a cleanup when contamination has been identified and a primary responsible party has been named?
Maybe I can clarify. That was my question. This
okay.
is Jason Weiner. I'm thinking of a particular site in Missoula where I live and work, and there's a, you know, the contamination, which is penta and dioxin, has been identified. The land currently allows residential use, and there's that nothing is happening with the cleanup because the, you know, the primary responsible party doesn't want to clean up to the residential standard, and I'm just not clear on where we go from here.
Okay.
And that, yeah.
Okay. Stephanie Wallace in our Montana office, are you still on?
Hi, Dan. Yeah, I'm still here.
Did you hear that question? You.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to make sure I understand it. Your thought is what could move a PRP to voluntary? This is privately owned property, I take it?
It's privately owned property. I guess I don't understand when a plan... cleanup is mandatory versus voluntary. It seems like
okay.
If you know if it's dirty and you made it that way, you got to clean it up. But maybe it's not that simple.
Well, that's a difficult question. There are certain sites that are forced to clean up because they are subject to regulatory requirements. For example, let's say a site was actively generating a hazardous waste after the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act was enacted in the 1980s. that site would have to get a permit from EPA. If they didn't get a permit, they would be ordered to do a cleanup if they caused a contamination because they're subject to regulation. There are other sites that were never captured by that particular provision. Maybe it was the type of contamination that they were managing. Maybe it was the time period that the facility operated. And at that point, then, it would only be required to be cleaned up if EPA or the state identified that as a site. And for the federal, in the federal case, it would be only if it, primarily if it were a National Priority List Superfund site, or there were an imminent and substantial endangerment to public health, in which case EPA might come in under an emergency removal action if the feeling was that there was an imminent and substantial endangerment. And in that case, if it happened under Superfund, under our Superfund law, we could require the property owner to reimburse EPA for doing the work or for EPA's oversight costs if we required them to do the work. If it's in Montana, there actually is a state Superfund program, and the state has listed certain sites, and not knowing specifically what site this is, I'd be happy to have you call me and we could talk about it. Let me give you my phone number. It's 406-457-5018. And I'm in the EPA Helena, Montana office.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a tough question. Thank you, Stephanie. That gets into a whole other ballywick, and that's when you've got contaminated properties that we would generally talk about perhaps having federal interest or a Superfund interest, something like that. And there's a process that EPA and states have for assessing those sites and determining whether or not there will be an interest and whether or not we would go forward with some kind of an action on those sites and maybe enforce upon that action. So if you've got questions about properties in that kind of realm where you've got residential properties and where you have concerns about human health or discharges to the environment, please go ahead and call EPA, call our 800 spill response line, et cetera, and we can take care of those that way, or at least address them. Were there other questions beeping in? I've got another emailed in question. What kind of cost is associated with EPA technical assistance? It kind of moved there on me. What kind of cost is associated with EPA technical assistance, i.e., to do an assessment? The cost... this is Melissa in Missoula. Whose cost? EPA's cost or the city's cost or whose cost?
Well, what I mean is earlier you were running through the different grants, the funding that you said, you know, well, hey, there's, you know, in addition to, you know, these financial things you provide, there's also the other. Let me find that slide real quick.
Maybe targeted brownfield assessments or something?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and then what cost?
The non-grant assistance on slide 29 where, yeah, I didn't know if there was some amount, say a city or a nonprofit, you know, would have to pay for the person's time who's coming out completing those assessments.
Okay, yeah, thanks for the question. That's a great question. There is no cost associated with that. There's no cost share. There's no match. This is something that EPA provides as a service if you want to request us to come out and do a phase one assessment, again, that kind of background assessment, or to do some sampling for you, to do a phase two so that you can determine whether or not contamination exists and cleanup might be required. There's no cost share requirement there. We're basically only limited by the amount of money we have, but with that said, we generally have plenty of money to assist local governments in doing these. The requirements are listed on our homepage. The Region 8 Brownfields homepage. It basically just requires like a one-page application request of us to do it, and then we determine whether or not it meets our criteria, which again are listed on that homepage of, you know, there has to be a substantial public benefit, that it depends on who's requesting it as well. You know, we want to do these primarily for local governments or nonprofit organizations, but if there's a substantial public benefit, we might do them for private property owners as well. So that's a good question. No cost associated, and it's very easy to request it of us. And we try to do as many of these as possible.
Ken?
Yeah.
This is Craig from Haver, Montana.
Hey there, Craig.
How you doing?
Great.
On the assessment grants, I noticed your success stories were specific to a local community. The assessment grants, generally speaking, is it more? Are you more likely to be successful in pursuing those funds when you have a specific community in mind, or are regional projects such as our area, where we have a five-county area, can they be as competitive as well? And if so, how would you make a regional approach more successful as opposed to something like a Sioux Falls or a Yankton or whatever the case?
Yeah, I really appreciate you asking that, Craig. That's a great question because it touches on something that we've changed this year about how we award our grants or our eligibility for grants for assessments. In the past, it's always been a specific community. So you'll have Helena, Montana, and they'll identify a few neighborhoods within Helena that have, you know, especially high, inordinate number of abandoned buildings, and they want to go out and do assessments there, and they'll get a grant, they'll apply for a grant and get a grant and go do those assessments. What we've changed this year is now we're allowing what are called coalition assessment grants. And instead of a $200,000 assessment grant to, for example, the city of Helena, now we can do a coalition assessment grant to coalitions of three or more eligible entities. And this is basically, it's three or more governments. And in Montana, that includes redevelopment authorities. And instead of $200,000 to do your assessment project, you can get $1 million for three or more eligible entities. So in your case, those five counties could come in and apply as a coalition for $1 million assessment grant. And if you target a specific area or a specific type of contamination you're going to look at, or, you know, you target, we want to look at abandoned gas stations. We want to look at properties along a specific stretch of highway or interstate. We're concerned about contamination at grain elevators. You identify more or less what you're targeting there. We're thinking this might be a very good approach because it's going to allow you a substantial amount of money, $1 million to do your assessment work. It's going to hit a fairly large area, and it's going to reduce the administrative burden because there's only going to be one grantee then for EPA purposes. Only one person's going to have to report to EPA. Only one person's going to have to deal with EPA. And the whole coalition can then benefit from the dollars, can benefit from the assessment, but whoever the actual one grantee county is, or the state, or the redevelopment authority, or whomever is the partner that becomes the grantee, they're the only one that would deal with EPA. So does that answer your question, Craig, or do you have any follow-ons?
Well, that did answer my question, but I do have a follow-up to that. I picked up on the fact during your presentation that the local grassroots participation in the planning of these projects is very much a key to success. With that, I would assume that would still be the case with these coalition assessment grants.
Absolutely. That's something that's always paramount for EPA, is that the community has been involved early and often in projects. One thing that we're changing for this year, the more you have partnership early, the more you've engaged the communities in the area that you're looking to serve, the stronger your funding grant application is going to be.
Sure, and it should be.
And with that said, one thing that we're going to do this year is you have to have community notification prior to applying for a grant, which says you have to make your grant application open to the public and accept feedback on that application. That's going to be a pass-fail thing. It's going to be very prescriptive with our grant applications. You write your proposal, you put it out for public comment, you have a meeting, and you respond to the comments, very much kind of like an environmental impact statement might be, or the NEPA process would be for an environmental impact statement. That's going to be a pass-fail. Where you're really going to get points if you apply for a grant is how you're going to engage the public going forward. What's your outreach going to be like? How is the public going to impact your assessment project, your selection of sites, how are you going to engage them in, you know, the vision for what the reuse might be and how this could tie into the economic development of the area. So that's really, for grant purposes, where you're going to want to show is that you're going to have a lot of public meetings. You're going to have a lot of outreach to different groups, English speakers, English as second language people. You know, that's where you're going to get your points now.
Great, thank you.
Absolutely. And again, we're going to have some sessions in July and August where we'll go in great detail on these kind of things. I don't say that to stifle questions here at all. Please continue to ask them. But we're going to get into all those kind of tips and tricks and where the points are this summer when you're getting closer to actually applying for grants if you're interested in doing so. Are there other questions out there? I've got a question here from Wilhelm in Missoula. Does EPA organize conferences or other opportunities for each state to share successes, problems with their voluntary cleanup programs? EPA has not gone state to state organizing these types of conferences. We have a national brownfield conference, as you're probably aware of, or a number of you are probably aware of, every 18 months, a very large national brownfield conference, which is free and rotates around the country. And then we have a Western brownfield workshop once a year somewhere in a Western municipality, generally hosting those. As far as state-by-state conferences, Colorado has an annual conference here, which a local nonprofit organizes and hosts. The city of Missoula is going to be hosting a Montana brownfield conference this fall in September 4th is going to be the date of that, a one-day conference there. And we encourage others to organize those types of conferences. But generally speaking, kind of back on that main theme of brownfields being, this is grassroots, this is the local communities taking charge of things. We try to generally steer clear of doing too much of the actual planning for workshops and conferences, as they're much more beneficial and useful for everybody if they're hosted by local communities and attended by folks from throughout that state based on that type of outreach.
Just to follow up on that, at the conference, the Montana conference in Missoula in September, there will be a session about getting to know your state and tribal partners. So you might want to attend that one. And this looks like a good topic also to have at potentially at our Western Brownfields Conference, and looking at the successes and problems and of the voluntary cleanup program. So I'm not on the planning committee of that session, but I'll definitely make that recommendation. And again, that Western Brownfields Conference will be in the first week of October, I believe, in San Diego.
Are there other questions or ideas out there that people would like to float out? You got a few more seconds before we start signing off here. All right, well, I truly appreciate everybody calling in today. Hopefully this is of some benefit for folks. Hopefully this didn't take up too much of your day. If you do have questions or thoughts, please feel free to contact anyone here at EPA or within your own state, your own state environmental agency. We will be having some future webinars like this. The other thing that I'd like to ask people to do in the final slide, if you'll advance through it, is fill out the evaluation form here so that we can improve upon these in the future. There's questions both about the technical aspects of the webinar itself, as well as the content of our presentation here. And any and all feedback is greatly appreciated. So with that, I believe we will sign off here. And hope you all have a good day and enjoy the rest of spring. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, everybody.